I'm Richard Porter.
I'm Johnny Smith.
And this is Smith and Sniff, a podcast in which two friends talk about cars and many other things.
Hey, one thing I've discovered this week is Manta-related banter that is... I didn't realise that it's part of German humour, a term called Manta-Fahrer, so Manta-driver. You know, like we have white van man here in the UK.
Yeah.
In Germany, I believe that Manta-driver, in inverted commas, is a thing, which has sort of tickled me a bit, because there is a type of joke called Manta-witz, as in, you know, Manta-wit, which... Again, I find a little bit funny.
Isn't it? It would be sort of the way that we would have joked about...
Capri people?
Capri people, or maybe then sort of like XR3 people.
Yes.
It's like, it's a certain sort of...
It's a stereotype, fish, isn't it?
Out-of-date man who...
Yeah.
It's probably, you know, meant to be a bit stupid, I think. Isn't that part of the Manta thing? Isn't
it? Yeah,
meant to
yeah.
Be a bit thick as well. It's quite cruel.
It is cruel, and I don't use Wikipedia as gospel. But Wikipedia says, the male owner of an Opel Manta is aggressive driver, dull, lower class, macho, and infatuated with his car and his blonde hairdressing girlfriend. Jokes poke fun at the stereotype of a working class owner of a second tier muscle car.
Second tier? I think that's quite generous, isn't it?
I was going to say, I'd say it was a bit further down. No disrespect to Mantas.
The Beezer Holmes League muscle car.
Who yearned for a sports car but couldn't afford a status vehicle such as a Mercedes or a BMW. Proud Manta owners often decorate them with chrome GT stripes, racing tyres or high beams to mimic the exclusivity of a race car. Well... Firstly, this is not a poke at Manta people, because I actually quite like Mantas. And you never see them.
No.
You never see them. I mean, what, 30 Capris to every one Manta, typically on the British road, would you say?
I'd say that's a reasonable...
30 to 1?
Ratio, yeah.
is it Capris to Manta?
Yeah, I mean, if that was a compression ratio, that would be remarkable. But... And it's funny because actually in this country, I feel like when they were both sort of current and even slightly afterwards, the Manta was more of the sort of thinking man's Capri, wasn't it?
Well, it was a sort of Capri with build quality is what I'm going to say. So I'm just pouring myself a cafetiere of coffee because I'm...
And a bit more sophistication because it was...
No, that's right. It was of, the... You know, but I think I've said this in a... it was probably a Smith & Sniff video. Ages ago, that I used to work with a guy that used to refer to them as Opel wife beaters, and because he said that in his when he grew up, the guy that drove the Manta was really aggressive, nasty looking piece of work, and wore a sleeveless T-shirt in all seasons.
And was this someone in the UK?
Yeah, this was UK based. Yeah,
because that sounds like that is the kind of
that's Manta
where the
father.
German Manta wit is going, isn't it? It's always vests, and I'm seeing now. I wonder where maybe some German listeners can help us out here. I wonder what the view would be of whether the Manta driver of the stereotype has a moustache.
Oh yeah,
because I feel like the moustache is maybe even still acceptable in Germany more than it is here. You feel Germany?
We
Germany
have something called States. Movember, Richard.
It raises a lot of money for a very good cause. I'm not going to diss Movember, though. It is, there's something very sort of blokish about it because it's such an absolutely path of least resistance thing to do, grow a moustache. But where that what Movember is supposed to be doing is going, we dare you to grow something that's essentially socially unacceptable.
Yes.
Well, so I did that. It's the bravery. It's the, you're going to look a bit daft. But of course, it's been going for so long now, everybody just goes, you're doing Movember. So it's not sort of, it's not what it once was, where you sort of have to fear.
I think people have made it stylish, whereas before it was very sex offender. And you had to be careful where you grew it. Not where
depends
you grew
how it comes
it, sorry,
in
where
as
you
well, doesn't
it?
It? You know, some people can go a full mansell and you're just going, I've got a moustache, deal with it. Whereas if you get a sort of wispy kind of bum fluff, like a sort of alopecia slug on your top lip, then you actually don't look good. So anyway, but I was in Germany, the moustache just carried on. I don't think it ever got stigmatised the way it did here. And the same in the US. You know, you get sort of like...
in the States, stateside tash, yeah.
Yeah. Wholesome dads, like Ned Flanders type figures, that just have a good old soup strainer and there's nothing embarrassing about it at all.
It's the... I think it gets away with it because there have been some highly respected lip slugs in music and film. And I think probably Viper from Top Gun has secured the American tash as being acceptable because it's a place of authority, moustache. And so,
well, I was going to say Tom Selleck.
Oh, Selleck, of course.
I think Selleck is the moustache ambassador for the United States.
I think he could. I think he's turned around even women that didn't like moustaches on men.
Yeah, I think my mum used to openly fancy Tom Selleck, and it was like, you know, I was sort of 8 or 9. You'd be a bit like, "What are you talking about, mum? You're married to dad." But she was, you know, you'd have Magnum PI on.
Yeah,
and mum would sort of linger about, going, "Ooh, is ooh." Where is he? Where? Oh, there he is. Ooh. And people be like, but mum?
Was the Tash more powerful than the Testarossa? Not a Testarossa, the 308.
I think it was. Also, the benefit of he could go inside buildings with it.
Oh, what? And you couldn't do that with a Ferrari, you mean?
Well, Magnum turning up to a meeting on the fourth floor going, now, a great expense, I've had my 308 craned outside the window because I want you to fancy me.
He's Magnum Oversteer OS. He just goes in very late to a meeting, goes into the car park, too hot, gravel, enters reception with the wheels still on. But gets out, just dusts the glass off his tennis shorts and walks into the meeting.
We've talked before, I think, haven't we, about how in the titles of Magnum that he does that, what could have been a horrific tank slapper.
Oh, yeah.
He absolutely boots it on grass and then does that tricky transition onto tarmac, which, as we know, is one of the hardest transitions in all of motoring.
Because
you can get really tripped up. Slippery to grippy is horrible. Slippery and he handles it really quite nicely. And you know it's him driving because there he is, waggling his eyebrows before he guns it. But
yeah, I think
there's a longer version of that, which is in the original titles, and I guess is taken from some bit of the show, I'm not sure, where, first of all, he slides the roof back as if you can do that on that car. And clearly there's a couple of people from the production standing just out of shot to grab it, and then he boots it. And they cut it. They cut into it later in the titles that were used for most of that series.
Well, that sounds brilliant.
But I'll, again, as always with these things, I'll stick that because there is a clip of it somewhere. I'll stick it on them.
I thought you were going to say there's a longer version where he overcorrects 16 times and it's actually a full minute of him going down the road. We're flailing at the wheel. We've all been there, but manages to not crash ultimately.
They've got the in-car shot as well where his eyes are very wide and his hands are very busy. His moustache is sort of like twitching side to side like an angry 1960s policeman.
Yeah, and he's trying to push air out of his mouth, but his lips are closed. It's that, you know, that thing where you're going to make a noise like this, but you're not making that noise. You're just you're trying to blow air out.
Yeah.
And, he's probably quite a quick rack on a 308, so there's a lot of overcorrection going on.
But no power steering, so actually quite a workout as well.
Yeah. Well, the Hawaiian shirt would be open, wouldn't it? So it'd be all right. You get a bit of ram air into the pits.
Yeah. But then the next scene, he's just talking to Higgins and he's trying to pretend he's not flustered, but he's just blinking too much.
Oh, yeah. He's absolutely, yeah. Oh, I know what I was supposed to. I was going to say huge congratulations in this podcast to my nephew, Ethan, for passing his theory test. He's stressed him out immensely, and he did fail previously. But give him a big whoop and say he's nearly on the road to freedom. He's nearly there.
Ethan, people who visited some of the Late Break live shows last summer might have seen Ethan.
Yeah.
He was the big lad with a very small child's rucksack full of car keys.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Which made me chuckle.
Had a Mickey Mouse rucksack with all the lots of expensive car keys in. That's it.
Yeah. Oh, well done to Ethan. That's good news.
Yeah, and it was the reason why I just quickly transitioned from the Selig chat to that is because I said to Ethan, I said, I passed my test before theories. Mm. But it was a very hot day, and the day he did that was one of the hottest days of the year so far. And I said, I remember being in my driving test, and I think I've said this to you before, I wore a retro terry toweling polo shirt type thing, and mm-hmm. my armpits were absolutely dripping, and I remember being so sweaty, and I don't normally sweat on that level, but I did. I doubtful the aircon was on. I'm pretty sure that it didn't have aircon. It was diesel Fiesta. But I remember it very well. Anybody else ever pass their driving test in exceptionally extreme conditions, either cold or hot? I'd love to know.
You didn't wear shorts, did you?
No, I didn't wear shorts. I felt like it was too casual, although I would have liked to have done.
Mm. I was thinking about this the other day because it's been hot. And shorts are fine if it's hot, but I just, British men who, as soon as the temperature goes above about 12, just put shorts on, even in 12. An office environment or when they know they're going to be sharing a car with somebody. And I always just go, no. I've worked with a couple of excessive shorts wearers.
Yeah.
And I just think, there's no need for it. It's just...
No, I'm with you.
TV's Chris Harris, actually, I noticed the other day, was doing something on Instagram and there were some pictures of him and he got shorts on. I was a bit like, everyone you're with is wearing trousers.
Yeah.
You look like an Australian. I don't know whether this is what you're going for. But
well, I have to have a word with them about his thermostat.
Yeah, well, that's it. But I suddenly went, I hadn't really thought about this. But yeah, I think Harris is a shortser.
He's a 3.65 shorter.
Yeah.
I think he is.
Ah, I see you're a shorterman. Well, yes. Let me tell you, wearing long trousers is what separates us from the animals, so put some on. I don't know, this is one of my weird Victorian attitudes that we probably should get over.
I'm a selective short wearer, but I've been doing shorts every day this week.
And, this past week has been, I'm wearing shorts now because it's a bit, you know, even at this time in the morning, it's a bit toasty. But
I decided to wear a pair of waterproof trousers for this particular podcast. The ones that you might wear on a commuter motorcycle.
I always favour a pair of those waders that Jeremy Paxman would wear before going into a Scottish river to catch a trout or something.
Yeah, it's those. I know the ones.
The ones with braces. You know the ones I mean?
Yeah.
Like there's a fine line between certain styles of those and clown trousers, where you think you could start stuffing balloons into the front of Jeremy Paxman's fishing trousers and probably get about 17 in there before one popped. What was I going to say?
If they were grey and you had a mullet and a moustache, you'd look like a Manta driver on his way to an industrial job. In Germany, obviously, not in the UK. Good old Mantas. Have you ever owned a Manta?
Have I?
Yeah.
No. I used to, our next door but one neighbour when I was growing up, Cyril, he was a serial Mantarist for a while.
I think Cyril.
He had about three on the trot over the course of 10-odd years.
Cyril's not a Manta name, Manta driver.
No, well, he was an architect as well.
Gosh.
So, but this is the thing. He was an architect and married to Jean, a lovely couple.
Jean and Cyril.
Jean and Cyril, yeah. And they didn't have any children, and so they could have a two-door car.
Mm.
And he liked a low-slung, sporty-ish car, but... He moved on to Sirocco's, by the way.
Okay, interesting.
Yep. Like Mark II Sirocco's. So he was a small man, and it seemed that sort of sitting quite low in a car with a high scuttle and shallow windows was not optimum for his stature. And he quite often got into scrapes. In a world before parking sensors, he was often scuffing his Mantas, and he worked in Macclesfield.
Manta
which
scuffs.
People who, Manta scuffs of Macclesfield. He often would be, he drove to Macclesfield, which people might know it is quite a hilly town. And famously, once he was heading down a hill in Macclesfield and a bag of shopping on the back seat tipped over, releasing oranges into the driver's footwell, and one got under the brake pedal and he couldn't brake hard enough, and he crashed into the back of another car and severely damaged his mantle.
Under the orange under the pedal.
I know. It's almost like something out of a sitcom, isn't
that
it?
It's really ridiculous. Is.
But it's, I mean, it was the 80s, so sitcom things happened, I suppose.
I didn't have a Cyril down our road. We had a Dave with a TR7. And we had a John with a particular favourite of mine. At the time, I don't think I realised how cool it was. A yellow first-gen Celica, the liftback, as they called it, didn't they?
Yeah.
So the proper little Japanese Mustang-looking thing. But in a canary yellow. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That was quite cool.
Hey, I haven't told you the more intriguing element of the Gene and Cyril fleet was not the 80s Mantas, because Jean had a Reliant kitten.
Oh, did she really?
Quite a novelty even then.
That's amazing. And he's an architect. It's not like they couldn't afford a proper car. I mean, a Reliant kitten, I actually like kittens, but they are a little bit agricultural, like all Reliants. Mm. You get in and you see, I don't know, no effort to hide the mishmash of weave of the glass fibre and stuff.
It's funny though, it was a quirky choice, but it wasn't totally batshit weird. It was just sort of, you needed a small car to get around,
town
it's
car.
Economical, and this is one of the ones that's available. I suppose it would have been, I can't remember what reg it was, but like probably a V-reg or something, so 1980, and this was, I mean, God, she had that car, I think she had that car into the 90s though.
What?
Well, it doesn't rust, does it? Fiberglass. So in many ways, quite a pragmatic choice for the... They were of a certain generation, a wartime kind of generation, where they, you know, they didn't chuck stuff away. Their house was like... I mean, now people would absolutely have creamed themselves over their house because it was full of mid-century modern furniture.
Oh, don't.
Which they basically bought... when it was new, in the 50s, I suppose.
When they got married, probably.
Yes, exactly. They were the second owners of that house, and the house was built in 1955, and I think they bought it in something like 1959. So it's, you know, and they just furnished it, and it was full of, exquisite woodwork. And also, it's the 80s. Those houses had parquet floors. Very unfashionable in the 80s. Everybody carpeted over them.
Yeah, they did.
But Jean and Cyril didn't. They just had parquet with rugs. And at the time, their house seemed really old-fashioned. And now you'd go, oh, my God, this could be in a design magazine. It's gorgeous. Of course, they've long since died and the house has been sold. But at the time, it was looking back, you go, ooh, that's all fashionable again now, that stuff.
Do the Mantas live on? That's the question.
Well, the Manta, see, that's the outlier, isn't it? Is the Manta fashionable again? I think the answer's no, but maybe its time will come.
I love the way you said that in a really shaky way. I actually think because of the world of resto mods and rally replicas, in a weird way, the Ascona has become a bit more cool because it's lesser seen, but there seems to be a bit more of a hardcore following in the rally world. I know the Manta, they did the 400, which was the hot one, wasn't it? But even so, I was always a little bit upset to know that the Manta 400 wasn't 400 horsepower, but then that's just me. And actually, maybe in today's terms and power, that should be achieved.
I was doing some reading up last week about, for various reasons, about Skoda rally cars, and... that Skoda Estelle 130.
The 130. The 130R?
It was a Group B car.
Was it classed as homologated? Group B?
It was. Because it's the thing that... And we sort of... We forgot about this when we were talking about some Talbot Sambas and Horizons and things being in rallying. And that Group B, you know, there was these sort of top flights... T16s and RS200s and 6R4s and stuff, but then there were all these other cars that were technically Group B cars as well, and one of them was the Skoda, which was still only a 1.3.
Was it?
Yeah, and it made 130 horsepower.
What?
And it was technically in the same broad category as the Lancia Delta S4, which was sort of tuned up to what 500 horsepower or
more.
Something.
More, they reckon more. I mean,
were they sort of knocking on like something idiotic like 750?
Yeah, they, apparently they were anything between 5 and 7 at various points in time. Yeah, same as the Audis and the.
It's one of those things where you look back and you go, I know why Austin Rover went for a normally aspirated larger capacity engine because they thought it would be more reliable, which wasn't really the case. But they were a bit thick because if they'd known anything about turbos and how, you know, if they'd looked at what happened in F1 already, they'd have gone, the thing about turbos is, if you sacrifice a bit of reliability or keep your fingers crossed, you can whack them right up.
That's right.
And there's no way you could turn that engine up in the 604 much, really, could you? I mean, I suppose they could have turbocharged it, but then they wouldn't have been able to have the same capacity, so it was sort of a waste of time. But, yeah.
If we had a time machine, that might be the first thing I would do.
If I could turn back time, I'd go back to the Austin Rover competitions department and say, oi, John Davenport, pull your fucking head together. I'd probably come with you.
Yeah, could you? I'd like that.
Yeah. And then we go, also, since you're developing the 604, can we have some of these old TR7 V8s that you're not going to need anymore? Cheers, thanks very much.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, I'd go on a massive car buying spree, wouldn't I? With the time machine, I'd probably buy a brand new Lotus Carlton.
Ooh.
I'd feel like.
Well, you'd have to wait, though, wouldn't you?
I'd have to wait a little.
Because we've gone back to 1983.
Well, a time.
To intercept development of the 604.
A time machinist never waits. They just adjust the dial and go to a different time.
You know, like when you're trying to find a spot, like particularly when you used to be on VHS videos and you'd overshoot or you'd undershoot, the same as like spooling past adverts when you've recorded something on like a Skybox or a Virgin Box or whatever, and you just overshoot a bit. And imagine if you were a time traveller and you went, right, I've done my work in 1983, but I really want a Lotus Carlton and I'm quite impatient, so I'm going to jump forward to the early 90s, and then you just overshoot and you're in like 1999 and you're going, jeez, all right, well, I'm going to watch this All Saints gig and then I'm going to go try and go back again. Oh, fuck, I'm in 1985 now. Damn this imprecise time machine.
Is it a time machine, like you say, it doesn't, the dial doesn't have enough increments on it, so you can get...
It's not calibrated.
No, you can be almost at the point that you want, but it's give or take a couple of years or a go.
It might even be a bit more, though, because if you think that the scope of the time machine, you could theoretically sort of go right back to, you know, 500 BC or something.
Did a bit of jousting. I know that wasn't BC, yeah. Was it? I don't know.
Oh, yeah, well, maybe that's the thing. You wanted to go back to the, I don't know, 16th century?
Yeah, 15th, 16th.
But, yeah, you fly right past it. But that's the thing. If you're just sort of dealing in... centuries, and you've built the time machine, the controller is it's just the fan control from an old Punto, and it's just not got enough increments on it.
No.
So essentially, if you're trying to just hit a specific year in the 80s, you're really, it's going to be somewhere in the late 20th century at best.
Do you know what, it's funny you should say that, because that's a bit like the volume control in some cars. Have you noticed some of them, you have to press it loads of times for the volume to go up or down?
Yes.
And then other times you tap it once and it seems to jump loads. And you're like, I want something in between, but there isn't anything in between. So what the hell am I going to do? So you end up just muting it a lot, which is what I do.
It drives me nuts. Also, I mean, I know you have buttons on the wheel and that's fine. And those are a mixed bag, aren't they? Actually, the ones in our up are very good. Nice, big, not touch sensitive, like newer VWs.
Yeah.
Nice clicky buttons, and a couple of jabs at one of those just does a good increase in volume.
Not too much, not too little.
Just give us a couple of jabs, son. And it works well. But if it was up to me, all cars would have to have a rotary volume controller on the stereo.
And even on the steering wheel, you know, the little serrated roller.
Yeah.
The thumb wheel. The thumb wheel's the ultimate volume control on a steering wheel. An up or a down tab doesn't quite cut it for me. And then you press it to mute.
It's calibrated, though.
Well, if it's... Yeah, I mean, if you touch it by accident and it goes from, like, volume 2 to volume 9, then, no, I don't want that, but...
Did you ever drive the MG6? Do you remember that?
Yes, I do remember the MG6. I only drove it once, but yeah.
It had the worst thumb wheels of any car. They were just... It's like they weren't. They didn't feel like they were connected to anything, but in fact, they were deeply connected and had an immediate effect. Even if they just a breeze blew across them, suddenly it would like change the radio station, or the other one would do the volume in a direction you didn't want. They were absolutely. You're just constantly brushing them while you're trying to get on with driving. Something's happening.
I'd take that over gesture control. Because,
well, this almost was gesture control because just a change in air pressure anywhere near them would cause something to happen. It was really irritating.
If you had the window open a little bit.
Oh, God, yeah.
It would be scrolling from Capital Dance all the way round to Classic FM in seconds.
Yeah, yeah.
I was going to say, there was actually a German film about mantas called Manta Der Film, and it was... Oh, two manta films. One was actually called Manta Manta. I've got to have closure on the banter.
Yeah.
It's a 91 German language action comedy. And sorry to any German listeners, if I don't know if this is a good film or not. Manta Manta stars this very body kitted yellow manta by the look of it. And the story, directed by Wolfgang Bould and written by a chap called Stefan Kantz, C-A-N-T-Z. Love that, Stefan Kantz. What an app.
Please tell me, I need to know this. Is it Manta exclamation mark, Manta exclamation mark?
No, it's comma.
Manta comma, Manta exclamation mark?
No exclamation marks at all. No. Okay. I don't know about Manta Dare Film, because that just seems like Manta the Film. It's just like, is that like Free Willy? But it's all the kids flock to the cinema because they think it's going to be about a huge, beautiful manta ray, and it's not. Mm. It's a terribly body-kitted car with a bloke smoking cheap cigarettes.
Small General Motors coupe. Manta the Movie. Mm. Interesting. Is it a documentary or is it a scripted?
It's scripted a film. I'm looking at the poster of it here, the theatrical release poster, and it looks... Imagine if you had a week to film a new version of Grease. that's it. Okay? So,
yeah.
That's the picture I'm painting for you. It's 80s Grease, but you only had a week to film the bloody thing.
Yeah, I get you.
Yeah, Manta Manta. There we go. Somehow I might have to watch that in the next 12 months. Maybe we should do it as Smith & Sniff homework. Watch it, report back on a film that nobody cares about.
I mean, I wonder if it's on Netflix or something.
What, Manta Manta?
Well... There's stuff on there you just never know about, isn't there? You could never get to the bottom of Netflix. It would take you forever. But so I don't know. Hang on, I can find this. Look, I've got Manta. I won't bother with the comma. Manta Manta on Netflix
film.
Nope.
Oh, that was a quick search, wasn't it? I knew.
But you know what? See, now obviously it then prompts you with things it thinks you might like instead.
Which is?
First one is Need for Speed.
Need for Speed instead of Manta Manta.
I know.
Okay.
Second one is called... Now, this is interesting because I don't know what the merry hell this is, except it's... Honestly, these three-word descriptions that Netflix do, have you seen this? I was sitting there last night in front of the telly, but I was waiting for my wife. She was doing something else and we were going to watch a show. And... it was just on its kind of, you know, Netflix screensaver, and it's bringing up shows you might want to watch, and it's not very original. I guess it's just based on what you've been watching before. So it was saying, hey, look, you could watch Seinfeld. And I was like, yeah, no, it's good, I will. And then it brought up Friends, and the three-word description was something like witty, quirky comedy. And I was like, quirky?
It's not quirky.
I guess it's one of the biggest comedy shows in history. I mean, I don't think it's quirky, otherwise it wouldn't have been that popular.
No, that's a lie.
Netflix thinks because it doesn't have Manta Manta, I might want to watch Borning 3, Asphalt Burning, which looks to be...
What?
Oh dear, I think I've just clicked and it's actually going to try and play it for me. So,
you absolute tool.
What the frig is this? More info. When the brakes slam on his wedding, Roy accepts a challenge from a new foe to race for his runaway bride at the iconic Nürburgring track in Germany.
Why would you race for a bride? Why would you do that?
Okay, it's a Norwegian action and adventure comedy, and the three words are offbeat, quirky, and exciting.
Right.
Well, if any Norwegian listeners have watched Borning 3, Asphalt Burning, then
I'm on IMDb now, looking at Manta Manta. There's a 2 minute clip, and it says proud German owners of Opel Mantas ', which I'm offended by, race the streets against VWs and Mercedes. They decide to set up a real race with lots of money involved. Full stop.
The person who wrote that is 10.
I just, oh gosh. Well, there we go. Manta, all right, well, Manta.
Let's try and track
pretty
down
sure. Pretty magic. Sure it's a comedy. I'm pretty sure it's a comedy.
But what if it's not?
But if it's not, then
I suspect it might be inadvertently funny anyway.
I think it might be very funny. It might be the next thing I watch, Manta Manta.
Yeah, I think it should be. Do not rest until you... You speak a bit of German, though, don't you? So
ein bisschen, but not much, no. I used to. I used to like speaking as much German as I could, but that was a long time ago.
Even in situations that didn't...
Yeah, me. I'd often speak it when going to Norwich, places like that. Yeah.
No. Is it weird that I find the sound of spoken German quite appealing? I quite like hearing German being spoken.
No, I think it's
precise about it.
It's very precise. I'd like to relearn it because they often speak German very quickly. So when I go over to Germany, I can only pick up small amounts.
Yeah.
But Yeah, my brother speaks pretty good German.
Does he?
Yeah, yeah. So, but he goes to Germany for a week a month for some clients who's a collectors of the cars, and
yeah,
he's their go-to Bentley guy. He's British Bentley guy.
Mm.
So he gets flown in.
Das Britische, is it Britische? I'm trying to remember it from that Rover advert. It's Britisha, isn't it?
I think it is Britisha. Yes. Yeah, richtig.
Now, guys, look.
Listen, what's up?
Last week, I foolishly mentioned my concerns about parking my cars on quite a steep slope.
Yeah.
And we've had more emails about this than almost anything in the history of this podcast,
people, you cluster of saddos. What's going on?
So I think I can't possibly read them all out. Honestly, there's so many. And thank you for everyone who took the time to write in. A general feeling that, you know, it's all okay. Leave your car resting on the pool. Lots of advice from people saying the thing is, where my Range Rover's concerned, is stop on the slope.
Yeah.
Foot hard on the foot brake, into neutral, handbrake on, then into park once you've taken your foot off the foot brake to let the car rest on the handbrake, and that will lessen the strain on the pawl. I should have mentioned, I tried that, and the handbrake is not quite up to snuff.
Oh gosh, here we go.
There's some creep. Which does sort of negate the point of putting it on, I suppose, but I feel like it's just an extra little kind of, like, you know.
Come on, have you seen how aggressively people, in especially 70s and American 80s American films, put the car into P when it's still doing 10 miles an hour?
Yeah.
I mean,
well, look, I wasn't going to read out loads of messages because there's just too many of them, but I thought I'll just go for the definitive. To me, this is the definitive answer because it comes from a patron of ours called Tim Dawkins. Now, I mentioned how people in San Francisco, or you mentioned it, how they cope because it's very hilly.
Yes.
Well.
Is he San Franciscan?
It's better than that.
Oh.
He's an automotive safety engineer who lives in San Francisco.
Oh, we're going to get the answer, 100%.
So he's my definitive source on this. Tim's actually British, but he lives in the US.
Hi, Tim.
He says, I heard your I'm Worried About segment this week and felt compelled to write in. as if you targeted the question straight at me. As a British automotive safety engineer who lives in San Francisco, it's my professional opinion that you should stop worrying about it, you big fanny.
Is that what he said?
This is fair enough. As you correctly mentioned, the purpose of the pawl in the automatic transmission is to lock the driveline from turning when you put the car into park.
Yes.
As part of a typical durability and validation program, this component, along with the rest of the transmission, is rigorously stress tested by the manufacturer.
Yes.
To last for a reasonably foreseeable life cycle, determined by the OEM of the order of hundreds of thousands of miles. The number varies by manufacturer.
Correct.
And evaluated using finite element analysis, brackets simulation, to ensure that it will last at least as long as the rest of the transmission, and physical hill hold testing in the vehicle to make sure it doesn't fail under load.
Well,
on a personal note, I used to drive around San Francisco in a 250,000-mile shagged old Hyundai Santa Fe, which had a broken handbrake cable, and I can say from experience, you would be amazed at just how steep of a hill you can find around here to try it for yourself. If you're any doubt, you can always turn the wheels to full lock and perhaps use your E-up as a sacrificial chock. I won't do that.
Sacrificial
chock. I think Tim, by dint of being an automotive engineer and living in a very, very hilly city, Tim is our definitive source on this, and I should probably just stop worrying about it, even though
obviously
I will.
Tim, fair play to that. Worry. I've got another patron has sent me what I think to be a fantastic answer to this that's not scientific engineer skilled in any way. So this is from Phil, aka Boring Car Driver. He's put, gents, listening to the most recent episode and Richard's concern about parking on his sloping driveway, I believe I've uncovered a mistranslation in the mountain legend recounted by Johnny in the episode before. I believe that the real story is that the amorous young Welshman was challenged into spending the night on a mountain, parked in a car without using a handbrake. This explains the pawl in the name, a reference to him being forced to put his trust in the auto box being sufficient to prevent the car running down the steep hill. I've been unable to ascertain whether he was expected to do this in the nude or not. I'm also unclear if the word hammer refers to the car being of legendary AMG model status. But given the relative scarcity in the depths of Snowdonia, it would seem unlikely. I hope this clears things up. Phil. Thanks, Phil.
It's very good.
That's well, next time I climb the hill again, I'm going to go quite soon. I've decided I'm going to conquer it again. I'm going to take a hammer with me, and I'm going to wear nothing but Crocs and an expensive watch. I'm going to take some Instagram pictures. So,
isn't Crocs and an expensive watch how we decided that Harry Metcalf would dress if he went full festival spec on his farm?
Yes. I think it's the sign of, it's just a sign of sort of carefree wealth, isn't it?
Yeah.
And that's why I'm gonna do it for the gram, as they say. I'm gonna do it for the gram.
So, right.
Yeah.
Okay. Fair enough. There was something else that we talked about last week that's drawn a lot of fire, by which I mean, you know, readers, listeners,
interest each other.
I mean, obviously, there's the aircon thing still rumbles on, but we won't get that. Jet towels. We're getting lots of pictures of jet towels.
Yeah, we are. We are getting bizarre, but Mitsubishi jet towel. And I want to see some mods. So, because it's called a Mitsubishi jet towel, I feel like there's going to be a keen aftermarket scene in it where people are going to put add-ons on it. So, for example, you know, my biggest bugbear with these hand dryers is that there's no receptacle to properly capture the blown-off water. Well, maybe there'll be some sort of vessel or a neoprene satchel, should we say. and then all of these aftermarket companies, and then, I don't know, different branches of cafes and things will start competing with accessorised jet towels.
Yeah.
Just love the name still. I can see it across the bonnet of a grey import car with a load of interesting logos and things that you can't quite decipher. Just think it'd look
amazing. Well, I feel it could be an incredible Japanese movie as well that we're just unaware of. You know, sort of, what was that film? Was it Condor Man, where the baddies had like sort of blacked out something or other?
Yeah.
Cars that were JDM stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, what about a sort of an all black Mitsubishi of some sort, some JDM thing that we've never seen over here, but it's all blacked out, like it's even got blacked out headlights and things. So it looks very sinister in daylight.
Is it a kung fu film? Is it like, you know, crouching tiger, yeah, hidden Jet Tal kind of thing? Going,
yeah. But is Jet Tal the car, or is Jet Tal the man who drives it? I don't know. But
I think it's an alias. The guy's known as the Jet Tal, and no one really knows his name, his real name.
Yeah.
He's like Deadpool, you know.
Yes.
But Jet Tal.
Yes, it's the Japanese Deadpool. Yeah. It's Jet Tal.
Exactly, there we go.
Wasn't there Jet Li? Was the but he's Chinese, wasn't he? So maybe it's a Chinese, Jet Tal is a Chinese action film.
Ah, yeah, Jet Li's, yeah, he's still
I think he's still alive.
He's still alive. He's still in full fledge on IMDb. Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, he's from Beijing.
Good. Okay.
He won five gold medals in the Chinese martial arts championships.
What?
Yeah, the first one before he was 11.
Bloody hell.
Yeah, that's impressive. Well done, Jet.
Hmm. Well,
so there we go. Wasn't expecting to talk about Jet Li today, Jet Tal Li.
No, but then, you know, it's always a bit of a wild ride, isn't it? Since I just mentioned my E up, somebody did get in touch, and I'm afraid I can't remember. I can't remember Stroker. Who it was, because I'm very badly prepared. Oh, yes, here we go. Jeffrey Smith. Hello, Jeffrey.
Jet Tal Smith.
He just sent us a message. Yeah, Jet.
What?
Jet Tal Smith. He just said, Mr. Porter, give us an update on the E-up, please, and thank you. I've in the best possible way, I have nothing much to report except that it's great and it's going well. And I filled it up with electricity the other day because it's been warm.
Yeah.
But I had the aircon, you'll like this actually, I had the aircon switched off.
Yeah.
Because the kids wanted the windows open. It was a hot day, and I was taking the kids out, and they really like having the windows open. And you know, here's something I don't like about that car, is that it doesn't have wind-down windows in the back. They just pop out.
They are pop-outs. It's the sign of a base model, isn't it, these days?
It really is, yeah. I think they sort of nabbed that idea off
Dacia,
the Aygo.
Dacia, yes. Love a bit of it.
Do they, though, actually, now? Do they still have pop-out windows
in the back? What's the seven-seater cool Dacia that's sort of bucking the trend of SUVs?
It reminds me... Dogging.
Is it the Dog End? What's it called?
Jogger.
The Jogger.
It is Jogger, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, because it reminds me of a Peugeot 505. You know, the seven-seat ones that were quite well-appointed. And were also a little bit... I'm going to say a little bit classless. They could have been a bit old money.
Couldn't
they? Especially the kind of the high end ones with the plush interiors.
Definitely. No, definitely.
I feel like it's trying to bring back the vibe of like, hey guys, if you need seven seats, you don't need an MPV or SUV silhouette. You could just have a car. Here it is.
So, but there's only the very far back windows that pop out on that, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
As in sort of windows in the back doors, though, I think it's mainly sort of super cheapy sort of budget. You know,
oh, yeah, that is Citroen C1, exactly. Igos. Yeah.
So, I mean, my kids don't seem to mind it too much. They just like to have their windows popped out, and then you've got to remember to pop them back in when you leave the car.
Yeah, because that is annoying.
It's a minor thing. But anyway, I'd had the con off because we'd had the windows down because it was this was a couple of weeks ago, and it was just sort of balmy rather than baking hot.
Yeah.
And then I filled it full of electricity, and it told me that its predicted range was 171 miles.
That's good.
The claim is 150, isn't it?
Yeah, officially. It is.
So that's actually, you know, that's quite, I quite like that. I sort of feel like...
That's good. Really good.
Maybe they've erred on the conservative side with the range estimate.
I think they
or they do it with the con on. I don't know.
I think they do it. Yeah, they tend to do that. But the conditions for EV have been optimum lately, providing you're not a con user. My Kia EV6, I got 293 miles out of it last week.
Did you?
That, my friends, is impressive.
Yeah, and that is impressive.
And that wasn't trying to hypermile or anything. It did that really honest Kia Hyundai thing of as soon as you switch it on in the morning or whenever, and it's charged, it just goes, right, you got 292 miles. And what it should say in really small letters underneath is, and unless you drive like a twat or you use too much heating/AC, you will get 293 miles, I promise. Because it's very, very authentic. Certainly has been in other cars I've driven, other Kias.
They, I noticed that way back, sort of the original Soul EV.
Yeah. 2014 and, spec.
Yeah, it was like the rangeometer was really, really accurate.
It was.
More so than contemporary electric cars. But they should have a little light, just a little red light comes on in the instrument panel that just says twat if you sort of, you know, you've used too much throttle or something like that.
Oh, it'd be a digital, just, part of the digital instrument cluster now, wouldn't it? A bit of a sort of swing needle into the twatometer.
Yeah.
Just be flickering.
I feel like something just flickering. Yeah, just goes twat. And you just go, oh, I don't want to be a twat. And you just ease off. It's sort of psychologically, it's quite it's powerful.
All based on throttle position. Well, I've still got, you know, I was doing some tidying in the shed I was looking for Beetle parts. So I've got hoarded Beetle parts here and there, you know.
For the car rather than like the insects.
Oh yeah, no hoarded insects. But although I do have a couple of water beetles at the moment that I've found in a saucer of water outside. Anyway,
hey, we've got newts. Did I tell you this?
No,
this house we bought has got a pond, and we were a bit like, what are we going to do with that pond? And then, well, we're not going to do anything now because it's got newts in it. I'm really chuffed.
That's brilliant. Newts. Well, that means the water's of pretty good quality for a start.
Does it?
I think so. Ah. And so just leave it as is.
Anyway, sorry, you were looking for Beetle parts for the car.
Yeah, yeah, and I found an original, not VW at all, but from when I used to go to Auto Jumbles with my brother pre-internet, I found a Smith's economy meter that works off the vacuum of a car.
Yes.
And it's just a swing needle, and I think the backdrop is it's coloured red, yellow and green, and it just swings between like, you're doing okay, no, too heavy footed, come stop again. And I was going to fit it to my car and I never did, and I found it and thought, oh, maybe I will fit it after all.
Didn't those things famously, if they ever, you ever did a little leak in them, they just make a horrible farty noise as you drove along?
yeah
they have to be airtight, obviously, because it's off the vacuum.
It's in my Mercedes 123, there was an air leak in the central locking in the passenger door. So when you were getting a bit of a lick on, it would sound like sort of a builder doing a quote behind the door panel in the bench, like going.
Will you be able to get the parts this week?
Oh, mate, yeah. I drove around it. I drove around with it like that for must have been half a year because I was too busy chasing tail and alcohol, but all I needed to do was actually I could have mended it with some simple duct tape, because it's quite brittle plasticky vacuum pipe that just had a little split in it. But anyway, this is not interesting podcast conversation.
No, is it ever though?
And it's never. Know. This is never an interesting podcast. It's ridiculous people listen.
Since we're sort of talking about cars for once, I wanted to tell you about something that happened to me, again, related to moving house, but this is a moment of absolute pure joy. I mean, I can't express how delightful this was, because I didn't think it would be possible. And some people had told me it was, but I didn't believe it until it happened to me.
Okay.
I told my car insurance providers that I'd moved house, it's a lower risk postcode, and they're giving me money back.
Are they actually?
They are actually giving quite a lot of money back as well.
Well, because you...
Mainly because I was paying quite a lot of money to insure.
Well, you're not off of London, are you?
Well, living off of London, high risk. Also, parking on the street and working in the media. They spin their big wheel of cash and then go, you owe us £47 million for third-party fire and theft. So I...
How much were you... go on then. What was your Range Rover? What was it?
The Range Rover was £1,100 or thereabouts for a year. Oh. It's now about £700.
Oh, sweet. It's nice to
they
have...
giving me in a world, money back.
In a world of predominantly gloomy news, that's lovely news, Richard. I'm really pleased. You can take me out for a curry if you want.
Yeah, well, I don't get all of that back. I don't get all the whole thing, because obviously it's partway through its term of insurance. But I'm still getting £300 back, I think, because... So that was delightful. But then the up was £400 and it's now £250.
Oh, that's just simply splendid.
Which is just
splendid.
It's so delightful. I mean, proportionally, that's more, isn't it? It's a greater fall. But
yeah.
Yeah. It's so, I'm so happy. And the Land Rover's old Defender will change as well. That's like they give me £150 back. So it's just, I'm so chuffed. It's not the money, it's the principle. It's the thought that for years, car insurance companies have been shafting me up the bunghole. And it's finally like, it actually feels like that. Because they could just go, we've got your details. I see you've moved house. Be lucky, and that'll be it. But they've I presume because they changed the rules, didn't they, to stop them being such arseholes, and I wonder if it's part of that. But they are legitimately giving money back to me, which that just feels like it never happens. So I'm very, very delighted. And the money will go towards mending all of the things in my new house that are broken.
You've told me, you telling me that's just reminded me. I went for a walk the other week, and I walked past two houses that were within very short distance of one another, and both of them had older Defenders on the drive, as in, you know, like a kind of like yours, a late old one, whatever you want to call it. And I chuckled to myself because both of them had other cars that they'd used to barricade them in for security reasons. So I'm thinking, and listen up if you're a classic Defender owner, I'm thinking it might become an insurance stipulation that you have to own a tender vehicle, which is a sacrificial lamb, because of the sad realities of them going walkabout because of their value. So one of them had a Skoda Citigo, which is a nice car, actually a little bit too good and possibly a bit too light. It would have gone for something heavier, which was parked. And the other one, more sensible, had a Mini Digger, which ordinarily you would box in with a car to stop certain people dragging a Mini Digger away because cos heavy plant's worth a lot of money and there's a good black market for it. So I chuckled as I walked and I thought, I wonder if Richard's going to do this now that he's a man of the country. He's going to... He's going, I've just bought an MOT failure Volvo 940 and I'm going to boat chain it to all my other cars.
I've bought a Volkswagen Phaeton that's got full electrical failure and I'm going to put it in front of my Defender and then let all the tyres down. It's completely immovable.
That's a great idea. Or put it in park and then just saw the gear stick off. Just bandsaw
or
the
super glue. I can't remember how they would work, but you know, that'll have a lock on it, won't it, when it's in park?
Yes.
Unless you've got your foot on the brake.
That's right.
Just saw
the brake.
Saw
the brake pedal off as well.
Saw the brake pedal off. Yeah.
So saw them both off.
Well, no. So then to get my Defender out, I have to pump up all the tyres on the Phaeton. I do need to release the transmission and the parking brake and let it roll down the drive out of the way.
No, I would do easier method. I would, like a barge on the canal, I would suspend old car tyres all the way around the Phaeton. Okay.
Yeah.
So that using your low range gearbox in your Defender, which I know you must use all the time, gently, you take up the slack to it and you just lever it out the way. Barge it out the way to leave, and then when you come back in again, attach a tow rope, and then drag it back round. So think of it as a gate that's not attached to anything.
I'm still going to have to pump the tyres up, but then it's going to be locked, isn't it? And they're four-wheel drive, a lot of those Phaetons.
Oh, sure.
So
okay.
I think it's going to be quite... I don't want to stress my Defender. What are we going to do? I'm going to stick to my plan. I roll it down the drive, get it out of the way, leave it on the road while I'm out in the Defender. When I get back, I've had a winch fitted to the front of my Defender for this to work. I back my Defender up to the top of the drive and then I hook the winch to the Phaeton and I haul it back
and
up in front of the Defender.
In.
And then into park, handbrake on, let all the tyres down. It's not going anywhere.
You winch the Phaeton in for a close kiss. That's what you do, didn't you? Winch it all the way up to it's almost
kissing. I mean,
it's not convoluted.
It's the work of a moment, isn't it?
Yeah,
no, it's not convoluted, not inconvenient at all.
No, I love this. This is the sort of conversation I enjoy. By the way, I think I'm just going to turn my earphones off. Hang on. If you can hear what sounds like somebody outside my house with a trombone, it's not. It's one of those slow trainer aeroplanes.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, you know, they do sound like someone's just walking around, circumnavigating your life with a trombone.
I got a right shock the other night. I was sitting in the garden and there's some trees at the end of our garden and suddenly I heard this and I was like, what the fuck is that? And the dog was like, bloody great hot air balloon sort of came up above the trees from nowhere, like it was springing out on us.
Brilliant.
But it was really low, like it was, you could see the people on board.
Bloody hell. And,
you know, they're big up close, aren't they, hot air balloons? And my first thought was just, please don't crash into my house, because I reckon it would make a right mess of your roof if a hot air balloon twatted into it.
I love the idea of... I've seen one this week, because I think, especially in the evening, it's good prime conditions for, you know, thermals.
It's good ballooning weather, yeah, because I've seen a few now. That seem to be quite rife around our new neck of the woods. But have you ever been in a hot air balloon?
No. I'd like to.
I'd like to as well. I sort of have this low-level fear that you'd get blown off course into some power lines, but I think it happens. It's not a regular occurrence, is it? So I'm prepared to go with it.
I would.
The experience.
I've never, ever done any parachuting either, but I would wear a parachute on board in case I needed to do a base jump. You know where you hold the pilot chute under your arm? I would do that. I'd say, look, it's not that I don't mistrust the hot air balloon, but I'm going to wear this.
But if you've never done any parachuting and then you turn up with a parachute on and they go, do you know how to use that thing? And you'd have to say, no, not really, but I've seen it in films. It looks pretty simple.
Yeah, I'm just going to throw the pilot out and pilot chute, that is, not the actual pilot of the hot air balloon. And then,
yeah.
But if you saw the balloon near your house rising, were they frantically like throwing belongings out of it to change its course?
No.
I tried to say to my son, who's fascinated with this stuff, inflatables and things, I did say to him, I said, look, the amazing thing about the hot air balloon is you can't steer it.
No.
So it's like going off, it's like taking a boat out into the sea and just sawing off the steering wheel or the rudder and going, right, we're going to use current and we're going to use the sky and we're going to use common sense to get home. And I think that it's so wonderfully deranged. I love it.
You wouldn't. Absolutely no way that you could use a hot air balloon for commuting.
No, not a chance. Because you never know. It'd be good for hot desking in any given place. Because
look, I work for Vodafone this week because that's where my balloon seems to have taken me. That's fascinating. Let's see what happens next week. Oh right, I work for UPS now. That's interesting. But yeah. I know. Sorry, I'm late. I've got a hot air balloon. A good excuse in a way, but I think
that's what it is.
Going, why don't you just go and buy a small Peugeot, you prick?
It's the directionless commuter. The strange world of a directionless commuter.
Like, do you remember The Littlest Hobo?
Yeah.
That TV show about the dog that just used to turn up and sort things out. Well, you'd be like that. It's sort of like a human version of The Littlest Hobo, but the randomness of where you go is driven by the fact that you're an enthusiastic hot air balloon pilot.
I really enjoyed The Littlest Hobo. My mum said that I used to cry when it ended. Apparently, I used to be quite invested in it.
Quite emotional, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And also that theme tune, fabulous theme tune.
There's a voice deep inside of me. Yeah, it's a good one.
Isn't it? Keeps on calling me.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I knew that. I was just testing you.
You're doing what my wife does, where she for some reason my wife can never get lyrics right at all.
No, I can't.
Sometimes
awful.
It really winds me up because I think she does it deliberately.
I'm awful. I'm awful at it.
Well, maybe you and her should form a pub covers band. And you'd just be the heck in the front. Johnny used to work with a rock. What are you doing? It doesn't say that.
Used to work with a rock.
It's work on the dock, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure.
I'm questioning myself now. Union's gone in strike. Oh,
yes.
Down on his luck.
Yes, that.
It's tough.
Yes.
Look, guys, right, we should bring this to a halt because last week on Twitter I was talking about how podcasts should only be an hour long, and so
it's true.
I'm going to call time on this because we're already getting perilously close. But before we go,
I've
got three things to tell you.
Yeah.
They are one, Johnny has a solo YouTube channel. It's called The Wake Wait Show, in which Johnny acts as a personal alarm clock for famed Middle Eastern hostage Terry Wait, rousing him from his slumbers ever so gently to avoid any clanging radiator PTSD mishaps.
Oh, stop it already. Stop it.
That's from listener Mike Follows. People keep sending these in.
I know
in.
They
it's
do.
Insane
You're an
now.
Absolute...
Second only to handbrake advice. Mike Follows, though, sent that one in. It particularly tickled me. I actually laughed very loudly when he sent it in, and I was sitting in the garden at the time. Looked like a lunatic. So thank you, Mike, for that. The real solo YouTube channel that Johnny has is The Late Break Show. Mm. Lots of excellent videos on there. And do not forget, in August, The Late Break Live.
Yeah, a.k.a. The Big Break event.
The Big Break.
is on.
Yes.
So it's a
happening. What is that? 6th and 7th of August.
6th and 7th of August, indeed. And
in the beautiful English East Midlands,
we're going to be there, and many vehicles of differing genres. Mm. Also, a live kind of like Q&A and a pub quiz, and
I'll probably turn up in my Defender, maybe dragging a ruined Phaeton behind.
I think you should do that. I think it's important to mention that at the time that this podcast goes out, you need to watch the Late Break Show. There is an idle chat with Mr. Harry Metcalf.
And, fully clothed.
Fully.
Not just Crocs and a watch.
No, fully clothed, but talking some great chat and showing me around his garage that I told him outright was a lie. It's a barn, not a garage. And he was cool with that. And he's. Harry's
you'll
lying.
Be hearing from the
garage.
Trade descriptions, people, Metcalf.
That's right. But no, in all seriousness, it was a good chat with him in the brown chairs, and then a walk around the garage, looking at a couple of lesser seen vehicles from his YouTube channel. We're talking about Evo and all that, and talking about the olden days when he had a moustache and a Saab Turbo. So yeah,
he did have a moustache.
Yeah, he had an incredible moustache and a brace of Saab Turbo. So even if you just want to listen...
Did he show you the picture? There's that picture, isn't it? Which was run in Evo at least once.
I believe we are in possession of the picture. Yeah, I believe
we are.
It's
a superb picture.
Do you know what? He could he could be British farming's answer to Tom Selleck in the 80s. But anyway, I want to please watch it and comment at will. And obviously, if you're a patron to this here podcast, thank you for being a patron and supporting us that way. It's really wonderful. Love you. And we have merchandise as well, which is expanding shortly.
Oh, yes. Someone's asked us for a hat.
Really?
On that note. Yeah. Just
should it be a sort of Madchester era kind of...
Like a bucket hat?
Like a bucket hat, yeah.
A bucket hat, maybe it could be. Yeah, a chap called Rob just said, I hoped before Goodwood you might have had Smith & Sniff headwear for sale, but apparently...
Well, we are going to be at Goodwood. We should publicise this.
This week, isn't it, in fact?
It is.
So we're there on Thursday and Friday this week at the Goodwood Festival. So we're filming for the Goodwood YouTube channel, but we will be around, and we'll probably be there on Saturday as well for a bit, won't we? So just in a social capacity. So come and say hi. We've got stickers. We're giving away little Smith & Sniff stickers.
We have got some stickers. And if you whisper sweet nothings in our ear, you'll get one.
Yeah. The second thing I've got to tell you is that, as you probably know, I've got various books out. One of them is called Boring Car Trivia 3. Please go and buy it, because then it will justify me doing another one at some point. And the third thing I've got to tell you is that until Skyfall, the most successful Bond film at the box office was Thunderball.
Was it?
Strange to think, but that is true. Adjusted for inflation, it is still the second most successful Bond film of all time.
Gosh, I didn't...
You wouldn't have thought it, would you? It's a bizarre one. But yeah, Thunderball...
it's holding that note, isn't it? We did that. We tried to hold that note when we were driving and all that.
Yeah, it makes you dizzy. Well, anyway, that's that for this.
Yeah.
We will be... Hopefully, we'll see some people at Goodwood. Come and say hi. We don't bite.
Yeah. And book a ticket for the Late Break Show live event. Do it now.
Yeah.
Just go to the website.
Go and buy some merchandise. Tell us. I can't remember. You did another call to action earlier on, didn't you? But I can't remember what it was.
Yeah, C2A.
Marketing term, call to action. But anyway, that's quite enough. We've gone well over the hour again. But we will do this all again, except we'll be together for the next podcast in the same place, probably at Goodwood somewhere, possibly drinking wine.
Oh, yeah. What a wonderful idea.
In the next episode. So join us for that next time. Until then, thanks for listening. Goodbye.
Thank you. Bye. And this is Smith & Sniff, a podcast in which we talk about cars and other things on that side of things.
Oh, you've gone too... you double-thinged it. That's even...
It is too many things.